in Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 4th, in Room 100 of Noyes Laboratory of Chemistry, 505 South Matthews, Urbana, the Geological Survey is presenting a public seminar titled Energy in the 21st Century. The markets are here, but the resources are there. The speakers are Drs. Robert G. Skinner, former director of the Policy Office of the International Energy Agency in Paris, and Robert J. Finley of the ISGS.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about some current research that gives some insight into the lives and experiences of young black men in the United States. And our guest for the program is Ronald Mincy. He's professor of social policy and social work practice at the School of Social Work at Columbia University in New York City. And this is an area that he spent a lot of time thinking about, doing a lot of research and writing on. And basically, he says that in recent years here in the United States, we've spent some stinking money in an effort, a successful effort, to improve the lives of poor women. However, at the same time, young black men have increasingly fallen behind in areas like employment, in their rates of incarceration, in their educational outcomes. In inner cities now, more than half of all black men don't finish high school. It's a problem, he says, that we can no longer ignore. This morning, we'll be talking about some of the research that he's done. He is the editor, by the way, of a book that you might like to look at. It's titled Black Males Left Behind, and the Urban Institute Press is the publisher of the book. Just a little bit more about Dr. Mincy, and by way of background, before joining the faculty at Columbia, he was senior program officer in the Ford Foundation's program, where he developed the Strengthening Fragile Families Initiative. And through that initiative, the foundation supported work, research, policy, and practice in responsible fatherhood. In fact, he's also done a lot of speaking on this issue, speaking and consulting with donors and researchers and policymakers and social workers who are thinking about similar kinds of initiatives in other places around the world, including South Africa, the UK, Jamaica, and other places here around the United States. He's also taught on the economics faculties of Purdue, Bentley College, and University of Delaware. His visit here to the University of Illinois is sponsored by the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. Questions welcome as we talk, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, glad to have you here.
Thank you.
There are a number of things, say, we could take as indicators of how young black men are doing, all of them clearly linked. Let's start perhaps talking about education. If you look at the group that we're talking about, basically we're talking about from the teens, from the mid-teens to the mid-20s, 16, 24. You see that in significant numbers, they either have not finished high school, or if they have, they've gotten nothing, no post-secondary education, nothing behind that. Can we talk a little bit about that? And is this one of those places where we're actually seeing a sort of a downward trend?
Well, this study focuses on young people who have not gone on to college. However, actually, the rates of college enrollment among African Americans have increased over time, increased over the 1979-2000 period. That's the focus of the book. However, black males have lower rates of college enrollment than black females. And that's part of, in fact, males generally have lower rates of college enrollment than females. So what this book was trying to address was, if you look at this, in the 80s, we used to call this larger population the forgotten half. Half of all Americans who are 18 years old and leaving high school do not go on to college. And what we were trying to think about was, what has been the economic outcomes for the so-called forgotten half in a period of extraordinary economic growth. So the backdrop is that when I was in graduate school, we were taught that all you needed was a period of sustained economic growth, and that would draw the most disadvantaged workers into the labor market. That turned out not to be the case during the 1980s, but during the 1990s, we saw rather dramatic increases in the employment rates of young women. But what this book points out is that over the same period, in fact, since the late 1970s, we've seen a consistent decline in the employment rates of young men and an extraordinary decline among young black men. So to sort of it's important to understand that the study was designed to ask the question, we had this extraordinary period of growth. What happened to all young men? And what we found was that the employment rates of young men generally, white, black, and Latino, fell. But those of young black men actually fell through the floor. Yeah. And then we wanted to know why, and then what might be some strategies to turn the situation around.
Yeah, and at the same time, to again make the point, underscore the point you make, at the same time, women, mm-hmm. the poor black women, actually did better. They certainly did much better compared with men.
Right. In fact, what we saw is that the employment rates of young, less educated women converged, black women converged with those of Latinas, and that for the first time in a long time, the poverty rates of black children fell, primarily because more young black women were working. Mm-hmm. So the question really is what explains this difference in gender in the performance of young black men and young black women? And again, what can we do about it? That's what my own work, I'm trained as a labor economist, but I've been working mostly in social welfare policy. And so I wanted to understand these things, and I want your audience to understand this as well. I'm not another hand wringer. I want to understand what can we do so that the prospects of young black women and young black men are growing together. And as a consequence, we create a better environment for our children.
Well, I guess it wouldn't be surprising if you look at this group of men who don't either have finished high school but haven't gone beyond that, or in some cases maybe even have dropped out of high school. And you look at that same group and you see that their employment prospects are not good, that right. also among them rates of unemployment are high, mm-hmm. and certainly rates of discouraged workers, people who've just even given up looking for work, is high. And so that doesn't really seem surprising. I would be tempted to say, well, there certainly must be some connection between their level of educational attainment and their job prospects. Is that in fact a simple line? You draw a line from one to the other?
Oh, absolutely. Especially because we are African Americans tend to be concentrated in large metropolitan areas, which are which have been the industrial base of the United States. However, manufacturing employment has declined throughout the United States since the since the early 1970s, and as a consequence, their opportunities to earn relatively high wages without a college degree have diminished. But the question really is, so have the opportunities for young, less skilled women. Okay, so we're comparing them to women who have the same levels of education. Why were the women doing much better? That's the problem that we have to resolve, because the poverty rates of black children would have fallen even more had their mothers and fathers been in the labor market, making money, and able to provide them with the sort of supports that they deserve. And I think the answer really is that in the 1990s, we had, in addition to an economy that was able to absorb many low-skilled workers, we had a deliberate public policy and a varied public policy intended to increase employment among single mothers, and that was welfare reform. And young, less-skilled women, unfortunately, many of them are single mothers who've not gone on to college, whose children have received some sort of public assistance. And as a consequence, they benefited from this strategy that both require them to work, but enable them to do so. And so we spend about $35 billion a year in the earned income tax credit. Now, young black women don't receive all of that $35 billion, but we've created an environment where if you work and you make low wages, we will provide a low-skilled, a less educated worker with up to $3,000 a year to cap off their low earnings. And this was a deliberate part of the Clinton administration's and the Congress's efforts to make work pay. On the other hand, if you're a less skilled woman, if you're a less skilled man, because you tend not to have custody of children, you are not you can receive about at most $300 a year from the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. So, again, we created an environment. We had an environment, a strong economy that was able to absorb less skilled workers, but we had a deliberate policy to require low-skilled welfare recipients to work, and then we had a set of policies that enabled them to do so. The earned income tax credit was the biggest part of that, but we also make substantial child care, Medicaid, food stamps, health insurance. So we created a set of supports that made work feasible for young, less skilled women. We did not do the same thing for less skilled men.
Yeah. Something also that strikes me, I don't know if it's a side issue, but it's certainly something that has affected all workers over this period. And it strikes me when I take a look at the data, some of the data that's in this book, and something that it seems to me that you can't quite get away from is the fact that essentially, there has been no growth in real wages for about the last 20 years. It's been pretty much flat for and pretty much for everybody.
Pretty much for everybody. And I think this is an important part of the subtext. Now, during the late 1990s, we did begin to see some growth in the earnings of the average worker. But if you look at the period between 1979 and 2000, the only men who earned more than their fathers were men who went on to graduate school. All other workers, I'm talking about workers who are college graduates, men, college graduates, some college, high school dropouts, their earnings grew by as much as 3%. And in some of those subgroups, their earnings declined by 15%. And this is the other sort of part of the story. While we did require welfare recipients to go to work, the other theme of welfare reform in the 1990s was personal responsibility. And for men, that means child support obligations. So many, somewhere between 25 and 50% of less educated men have child support obligations. Since the mid-1970s, we've become very effective at collecting the child support obligations of men who have children who receive public assistance. At the same time, their capacity to meet their obligations has fallen across the board. So because most men earn little more than their fathers, I'm not saying that they should not meet their responsibilities to their children. However, we've become much more effective at making sure paternity is established, that child support orders exist, and that we can intercept men's tax returns, do a whole variety of things, which we should. However, their ability to pay their obligations has fallen, and that affects these young men as well. So those who do work, they will have child support obligations of 17 to 23% of their income per year. So from their vantage point, for young women, because of welfare reform, we increased their earnings capacity if they were willing to go to work. For these young men, we've actually decreased that because we take away money to pay child support. For many of them, if they meet their child support obligations, they end up poor or near poor. And again, none of us get up in the morning and go to work and in order to be worse off. And that really is the consequence for many of these young men. So I think we have to have a strategy that says we're going to require you to meet your obligations to your children, to society, but we're also going to enable you to do so. And the questions that I begin to muse about here are, what are our minimal sort of requirements for citizens, for these young men? And secondly, how are we going to help them get there?
If you look at this group and the numbers who are live-away fathers, non-custodial parents, men who have fathered children but don't live under the same roof with them, are the rates higher than for other men?
Absolutely. So we have black men, and I think this is a small part of a huge picture. Mm-hmm. Today, about 30% of all children in America are born to unmarried parents. But the interesting information is that while marriage has declined, cohabitation has not. About half of children who are born to unmarried parents are actually born to parents who are living together. And over time, what occurs is those parents separate, and today more single mother families are being generated because of a birth to a cohabiting couple. That cohabiting couple later splits up, and then you observe a single mother and a child. But for African Americans, they tend to have children born out of wedlock without cohabitation. And so their fathers almost never live with them. And as a consequence, most black children grow up without having ever. 70% of African-American children are born to unmarried parents. That number is extraordinary. And it's been, but it has been extraordinary for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So many of the young men we're talking about here grew up in a single-parent home. And what we know is, as did I, so this is not beating up on single mothers. They're heroes. However, we are posing extraordinary opportunities, obligations, burdens on single mothers and parents to raise children generally and to raise black boys in particular. And part of the solution is to get more of these young men to remain involved in the lives of their children so that we know that children who grow up in two-parent families, we know that children who have the involvement of their fathers in their lives, whether or not the parents are married, have higher levels of high school graduation, are more likely to get A's in school. So part of the solution here is a long-term one. Let's look at this current cohort. This is why I'm worried about this current cohort of young men, because I'm looking through to their children. If their children grow up with only the inputs of their mothers and their mothers' in-laws. When men separate from their children, we're not only losing the fathers, but we're losing the one half of the child's extended families. What are the adult supports available for children? And this is where my interest and concern about this population arises.
For anybody who might have just tuned in here, let me introduce again our guest, Ronald Mincy. He's professor of social policy and social work practice and the School of Social Work at Columbia University in New York. And he's here visiting campus, sponsored by the folks in ACES, the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. He's an economist by his training. He's the editor of a book that pulls together a lot of recent research looking at this group that we're here talking about. If you want to look for the book, it's titled Black Males Left Behind. He is the editor, and it is published by the Urban Institute Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go ahead anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here. Bring them into the conversation, starting with someone in Champaign, and this would be line one. Hello.
Hi, this has been very interesting so far. It makes me feel very thoughtful. I was wondering, in this whole question about fathers leaving families, do you know in other ethnic groups, other racial groups, how does that compare? How many fathers leave in the black community versus other communities? And then what is it about the black community that men don't stay with their families? Is there a pattern? Are there root causes? Is there something going on? I'm just kind of curious about that, and I'll listen offline. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for the question. What we know is that rates of unmarried births are rising across the population among whites, among Latinos a little less so, and they are very high among African Americans. What is occurring among whites, again, as I said, that you have many who cohabit during the birth of their child, but as the relationships between the parents deteriorate over time, and cohabiting parents, by the way, earn less money than married parents, and as a consequence, the economic stresses and other stresses that they experience, they are likely to separate over time. And so today in the United States, not among African Americans, but in the larger population, about 60% of all children in the United States live without their fathers. So this is a huge problem that is affecting particularly less educated Americans across the board. In acknowledgement of this, the Bush administration has been interested in promoting healthy marriages in the United States. And this is a very controversial social welfare policy. My own view, having grown up in a single-parent home with a mother who raised three young men all by herself in a housing project in New York City, I don't have strong conservative credentials, but I'm not crazy either. The input of a father in the lives of children, both to provide financial support and guidance and the like, is important to child development. And I think, in part, what we need to be doing is encouraging parents who are interested in marriage to stay, to do so. We found in a study that I'll be talking about today, we undertook the first survey ever in the United States of unmarried parents and their children. We interviewed the mothers, the fathers, and the children, and those children are now 5 years old. At the beginning of the study, 80% of those unmarried parents said that they thought that their prospects of marriage were good to excellent. 1 year later, when their children were 12 months old, only 15% of them had married. So I think part of the solution, both among African Americans and in the society generally, is that we need to be enabling enabling young people who are interested in marriage to fulfill their own desires. And if we do so, more of their children will grow up in two-parent families, and as a consequence, those kids will do a lot better. This is important for whites, and this is absolutely important for African Americans.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Indiana there, the next caller. Line number four here, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me that last statement's important for all groups, whatever. As a child, I was sort of lucky in some ways. Some of my friends, black friends, made the jump and are now what we would call middle class. I've lost track of them, but they all got out of high school, either got good jobs or went on to school. And I remember first time I come across this situation of young people not having a father in a house for, you know, an entire period of the relationship with their biological mother, there seemed to be an edginess. And I was wondering if, rather than doing, you could also do the conservative thing, which I don't think is really conservative. Facts, you know, bear it out that having a mother and a father around, or a male and a female of some sort, to have a relationship is much better, even though it may be, you know, just incremental in some places. I'd like to see, I know it's not going to happen with this administration, but since we have these children, I'd like to see other programs that, and somehow, can rub off that whatever in the hell it is that causes them to, you know, just in broad strokes, take the rebellious angle, you know, continue it. You know, all children do that at one time or another, but just continue it. And I've had experience with those kinds of fellows. And in volunteer work, I've talked to them, and there's a wall there that one can't get through, unfortunately, whatever kind of metaphors you try to bring up and to explain things to them about what their future looks like to them. I just got to the problem where I think that they don't think in terms of future like you know, since the middle class, quote-unquote, do. I was wondering if you could make a comment about that and what you think your goal is and, you know, how to restructure all this, what you think needs to be done. Well, however speculative, I'd like to hear that, too. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, you know, there has been a lot of work in a field called youth development, which basically tries to diminish the distinctions that we make between children who grow up in upper-income families and children who grow up in lower-income families or single-parent families or whatever. And what it says is that young people need there's a common set of skills that young people need in terms of their – obviously their education, food, housing, and the like, but also their abilities and opportunities to learn a set of skills and to contribute to their communities. But they also need – individuals who are really focused on their development, people who they can communicate with and the like, and that we, in thinking about how we help youth make transitions, that we need to think about low-income youth and upper-income youth in the same way. They need to develop the same set of competencies, and then they need to develop similar sorts of opportunities to transition. One of the challenges that young black males have experienced then is that because resources for youth development sorts of programs have declined across the board, especially in the 1990s, and workforce development sorts of efforts, their abilities to come out of their communities, or not to come out of their communities, but to have experiences beyond those of their communities, have diminished. I grew up in a housing project in New York City, but I can recall having after-school programs where I learned how to play music, learned how to play the saxophone, played basketball. You know, there were lots of opportunities for me to learn other things, to develop a set of skills. And those opportunities were extended to members of my cohort as well. But in many school systems around the country, after-school programs have been diminished. Music, art, opportunities for young people to learn a skill set have really diminished. And I think that has an important role with the kinds of outcomes that we're observing among them today.
Mm. Well, just to hang for a minute with the other part of the question that the caller asked, and that is, you talked about the fact that this administration has talked a lot about the importance of families and trying to do what you can do to encourage
marriage.
Men and women, encourage marriage. Yes. In a word, yes, encourage marriage. So then the question is, well, okay, how do you do that? And even that, then that seems to beg another question that says, well, even if people get married, What do you do to try to create an economy and create opportunities for them so that they can actually earn a living to support a family? But maybe, you know, and I think a lot of people would say marriage is not the be-all, end-all. But if we want to do that, if we want to encourage people to get married, then is there some way that you think that government can actually do that?
Well, let me sort of put this in context. The issue really is we have a variety of strategies for assisting low-income people, all right? And my interest in encouraging marriage is really an interest in inserting marriage as one of many things that we do to improve the life circumstances of low-income children. Not that it's the only thing that we should do, but it sure enough should be one of the things that we do, in part because the evidence is pretty clear that children who grow up with both of their biological parents do better in a whole range of things in terms of graduating from high school, going on to college, and more that we could name, than children who grew up in single-parent families. Not because single-parent families are bad, but because children who grew up with both of, in fact, children who grew up with both of their biological parents do better than children who grew up with a biological mom and a stepdad or a biological dad and a stepmom. It appears to be extreme about this, that nothing replaces for the value of children both of their biological parents. Now, why might that be? Because in a case in which children grow up, in most cases, when children grow up with both of their biological parents, their parents learn how to parent together over time. It's not that they are the best parents on the planet, but they make their mistakes together over the course of their child's development. Moreover, in two-parent nuclear biological families, there is never a question as to whether or not, usually, never a question that both the father and the mother have that child's best interest in mind. On the other hand, it is very difficult to raise children. You do need the engagement of two people to get that job done well. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why children who grow up with both of their biological parents do better. Now, how might we encourage marriage? My own view is that we need it. We need to create a set of circumstances where parents have the economic wherewithal to support their children. Right now, the healthy marriage policies are not working on the economic portion of it, and I'm discouraged by that. What they are doing, over time, we've spent over the last 20 years millions of dollars in investments in helping young, middle-income white parents overcome the shock of childbirth. Okay, so what the research has shown is usually young people get married, they spend the first 5 years childless, they are investing in their relationship over time, and boom, they have this thing, a child. And it's a very stressful event. What they find is that marital satisfaction declines during the first several years of childbirth. So this happens especially in the military and in other environments. So we've invested in how to help parents develop a set of relationship skills so that their marital satisfaction is sustained during the shock and the first 5 years of childbirth. What the government is attempting to do is to figure out how can we transition the skills that we have taught middle-income white parents, and these are relationship skills, to lower-income and minority parents to, A, help them pick better marriage partners in the first place, and secondly, help their relationships sustain the various shocks that they experience, shocks associated with low income and the normal things that happen between men and women over time that cause their relationships to deteriorate. Now, again, this is not the only thing we need to be doing in social welfare policy, but it's clear that if parents have the benefit of both of their biological parents over their life course, those children are going to do better, and we taxpayers we'll be spending less of our limited resources on poor children, and as a consequence, we will have more resources available for those children who, despite these and other sorts of investment, grow up in single-parent families and really need help. We'll be concentrating more of those resources on those who are most in need and actually move some of them out of the way because they'll have two parents who are working, who have higher income and are better off. So I just think this is part of the set of strategies that we're using. And we're going, as a consequence of the Healthy Marriage Initiative, which is now spending about $3 billion to do this, we'll know more about it over time.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. We have a couple of other callers we'll get right to. I do again want to reintroduce the guest. We're talking this morning with Ron Mincy. He is professor of social policy and social work practice at the School of Social Work at Columbia University in New York. And he's here visiting the campus, a visit sponsored by the folks in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. He is an economist by his training. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our next caller here is In Rantoul on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, hi. Another interesting program. Thanks for taking my call. Just an interesting story I have to relate, I think, which dovetails nicely into the topic, and then a quick comment, and I'll ring off. About 15 years ago, I received my master's in public health from the University of Illinois in Chicago, and I was involved in a joint project called the Great Cities Program, with the Chicago Department of Public Health. Anyway, our program was lead abatement and lead poisoning, trying to eradicate that, which greatly affected the inner city and housing projects, what have you. And the idea was, well, since we're removing the lead from these inner cities, perhaps we could hire inner city youth, primarily young black males, to do the eradication, to do the abatement, thereby, you know, kind of killing two birds with one stone, providing employment and getting rid of a problem. And what we found, the program itself kind of disintegrated from within. We didn't have enough individuals that could do the training because of either lack of education, substance abuse problems, or prison records, whatever. And so I think it was a well-intended program, and I think it could have served a lot of purposes, but it kind of disintegrated. And my quick comment was, there's a story coming out of Chicago last week about they did a study for the museums in Chicago, and overwhelmingly it seems the populations that attend are middle class, white, you know, two-parent families, children, and so on and so forth. And the comment was, well, we need to have the board of directors on these various museums make their museums more racially sensitive. And I don't think it's so much as the museums are insensitive. It's, you know, my parents took me to a museum. I took my wife and I took our children to a museum. I think it's something families do. I don't think it's necessarily a racial issue, but I think, again, if you come from a single-parent family, you've got a whole host of things that you're fighting against, you know, right from the get-go. And anyway, those are my quick comments. An interesting program. I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, your comments just bring a whole lot of things in mind. First of all, your program, this lead abatement program. In the 90s, I worked with a fatherhood program, the one that was featured in the New York Times article. And their first grant involved a similar lead abatement program. However, this program was housed in Baltimore, one of the cities with the highest level of drug trafficking and the like in the United States. Now, what I found interesting about your comment was that you were unable to – the program disintegrated from within – in part because you had many of the young men who worked there were had substance abuse problems, were ex-offenders, and somehow that disqualified them. I understand how the substance abuse might. I don't understand how their incarceration experience has. Well, this lead abatement program in Baltimore worked with a lot of ex-offenders. But the fact that they had an employment opportunity coming out of prison was in part what resolved their immediate need for cash. So when an ex-offender gets out of prison, they have an immediate need for cash. They need to find a job. They need to get reconnected to their communities. And the fact that their criminal records are barriers to employment is one of the things that increases the likelihood that they will go back to prison. I also, when I was a grant maker, was a funder for a program called Youth Build. And Youth Build is now a national program. It's in several metropolitan areas all over the country. It works with young people, men and women, provides them with construction skills, puts them to work in construction, but it also then uses this as an opportunity to do youth development, to teach them how to work together as teams, to engage them with mentors who care about them, and helps them give back to the community. Again, very disadvantaged people. Youth Bill is one of the most successful youth development programs in the United States, in part, but many of the people who work in Youth Bill are ex-offenders, and they come from communities. So I think your experience is useful, but it's sort of not the record on what happens when you give young people opportunities and facilitate their need for cash. Many of these young people, by the way, went on to other careers having nothing to do with construction. The point was that it was an entry point into learning a skill, learning how to work outside of their own environments, and learning the set of communications and other skills that will enable them to get a job. On your museum thing, it's very interesting. The Smithsonian is about to do the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., which, you know, talks about history and culture and the like, is about to do an exhibit on hip-hop. Because hip-hop has been one of the most important cultural phenomenon in the United States and around the world. That's the grand irony here. On the one hand, the fashion, the music, the swagger, the affect of hip-hop culture is one of the most popular things we have experienced in the last 50 years, not only in the United States but all around the world. Yet, if you take a young person, a male, who has grown up as part of that subculture, that person cannot take that subculture and walk into this studio and get a job. So we're sending some really complicated messages to young people. And the men, at least, have no opportunity to learn a different set of messages. The women have, in part, because through welfare reform, they got what we call life skills. They got job search skills. They learn, honey, if you want a job, you may have to comport yourself differently. You may have to wear different clothing. You may have to take off those earrings. You may have to acquire an affect that does not that is not off-putting to customers. You may have to learn how to respond to the authority of your boss. They learn that as a consequence of preparing them for work. The young men who grew up in the same neighborhoods, they have the same affect, but they have no opportunity to learn how to make a change. Mm.
Just to underscore something that you said, and this is one of the things that I wanted to bring up, and again, I thought about taking a look at some of the stuff that's in Black Males Left Behind. When we see in this group of men that we're talking about low rates of employment and high rates of incarceration, so it is the case that prospective employers, when they're looking at whether or not they're going to hire a young man, that if they see that he's spent some time in prison, he's just going to say no, sorry, we could cross him right off the list.
He's done. And this is a huge problem. First of all, numbers about 600,000. African American men between, say, 15 and 30 years old are being released from prisons in the United States every year. So this is in part a reaction to the crack epidemic of the 1980s and our criminal justice response, a response, by the way, that many in the Black community favored. We were concerned, and rightly so, about the effects of drug trafficking on young children, and fully complicit with a policy that says, let's make drug trafficking, weapons carrying a felony offense, and let's get these drug traffickers off the streets. So now we're living on the other side of that experience. Many men are coming out of prisons, but the fact that they've had a criminal record is a definite barrier for them to get a job. In addition to that, because communities are so highly segregated by race, they live in communities where other men who have not gone to prison are also denied employment opportunities because employers generally don't do background checks. So if you're a young African-American male, you have less than a college degree, and you live in a certain neighborhood, I'll take your resume and throw it in the trash. So the high rate of incarceration among young Black men is a barrier not only to those who've gone to prison, but for those who have not. This is just patently unfair, but it is also part of the process that then produces the numbers that we have here. And in some mm-hmm. cities, these numbers are really extraordinary.
Well, let's take some other calls here. We'll go next to someone in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. Listening to you talking about statistics, just wanted to give you, well, there's three things I want to say, but one of them is to say that it's important for listeners to also hear you say that you're talking about statistics, not individuals, because for many people, staying in a marriage and having a very dysfunctional model is a pretty bad thing for kids growing up. It depends. Of course, it depends on what you define as dysfunctional. But we should realize that some marriage is not better than a marriage where the kids are learning really bad lessons about life and about interactions with people. So that's one thing. I also think that now I've raised two kids and I've been married for some time, and I think about my own learnings and my own reactions. And I think a lot of what we do is based on models that we have absorbed as we're growing up or that we notice in our lifetime. And I can remember seeing people doing something differently and thinking, oh, that's a good idea. I like the way that's being done. Or isn't that a, you know, I don't like that way that they're interacting. It seems to me that kids who don't grow up seeing a healthy relationship don't learn how to do the relationship. And I think that we need to find ways to teach kids about relationships, to model them and about human interactions at a young age and not only at the point where they are considering marriage or are in a relationship and producing a child. Because it's just so complicated. And I think we would have much more success if we could find ways to do that. A lot of times when we're parents or when we're interacting with in a stress situation, we fall back on models that we have seen. If we don't have healthy models for alternative ways of doing things, we don't have those instantly at our reaction. You know, when we need something to react with quickly. And the third thing is that I live in a city that's getting bashed because our city council voted to say that we don't like being in the Iraq war. And they did that because of the funding that is being siphoned off to pay for the Iraq war and the debt that's being incurred. And we need to stand up and say, folks, you know, why is it that we always have money for war and we're willing to go into deep, deep debt for war and we're not willing to invest that money? That cost is showing up in what we're not willing to invest in the lives of children who are here with us now.
Well, you raised some good points. Let's get some comments here from the guest.
Well, in the main, I'm in agreement with the caller. I think, first of all, marriage is not a panacea, and there are many people who, unfortunately, are in marriages where couples are not managing their relationships well, and no one should have to suffer through that. But I also agree in part with what you said, that we have difficulty in this society even talking about marriage. And this is something that we've all gone through, myself included, as we begin to think about what are the various strategies that we're going to use to help people get along and survive and do well in this culture. And interestingly, marriage has been off the table in terms of something we might do for a long, long time. It's not as if children have no models of relationships. They do. But the models that they have are of men and women who come together, who have children. Those relationships expire over time. What they don't have is models of how couples learn how to manage their relationships well and how to sustain their relationships. And all I'm suggesting is that among the things that we do for young people and children in particular, they ought not to be getting models by accident. They ought to be getting well-structured models deliberately. To the extent that we've spent 20 years and several million dollars teaching upper-income people how to manage their relationships and as a consequence, improve their marriages and improve the familial context for their children, should we not take advantage of that investment to teach lower-income people to do the same thing? I mean, I just don't see the problem. This war is consuming resources that will that have placed us in a budget deficit that we will be dealing with for the remainder of my career. I think it is a tragic event. It is having huge consequences on the resources that we have available to deal with domestic issues in our society. And I will be glad for the day that we can pull out of it as well.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller for the comments. Let's go on to a Belgium community nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. Earlier in your discussion here, one of the participants here, I think it was Mr. Inge, stated that the income for all people have gone down. And I want to take slight exception with that. It seems to me that the people at the top, their income has not gone down at all. CEOs of companies have done very, very well. But I want to tie this straight back to the previous caller in that since the 70s, the true concern about business is that it's the bottom line. It doesn't matter what happens to any employees or anything else, as long as the shareholders get a very high return on their investment. And now, I can understand that, but other countries don't tend to put it all that way. They put it a little bit more socialistic, and well, the companies can do well, but we need to give some of that back to the participants in the country, or the society, however we want to put it. And just as the lady before mentioned, the accountants worry a great deal about how much money is coming into the bottom line of a company, but nobody seems to want to watch the P's and Q's and nickels and dimes of this war that we got. Just like the lady said, we worry so much about how much somebody's getting returned on their investment, but this investment we're putting in our country, we're squandering it in another situation 100%. And if we didn't worry so much about that, many of these social problems could be taken care of. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, again, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I think I can't. I made my previous comment. Right.
Well, let's go again to Champagne. This is line 1. Hello.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I hear you sort of running around the periphery of extended families. I think anymore you're getting fewer people born and more interaction and more sophisticated interaction, and people grow in different directions. And so I see some patterns developing amongst the affluent community where you have cathedral houses, two people, one child or three children have moved out. There's no interaction very much with the people around. I would much rather see planning which involved clustering of houses where there are 10 or 12 families together. They move in and out of each other's domains fairly freely and interact and educate each other and enjoy each other. And I think sometimes the marriage of two people going into the act two by two is extremely stultifying. And I think I look for other things like extended families to be encouraged. So let's not put marriage on too much of a pedestal. It was, a few centuries ago, peasants and others, native communities especially, did very well at being integrative in a broader community. And I wish you would say something about that.
Okay.
Well, the nearest thought that I have is this, and it's not exactly what you said, sir, but, you know, we have this phrase, it takes a whole village to raise a child. And I have some respect for it, but I'm a little concerned because I think we use that to absolve individuals of their responsibility for their own children. Yes, it takes a whole village to raise a child, but some of the people in the village are crazy. And we need parents. No one is going to protect my child in the way I am. I need to be available, and my wife needs to be available to intervene between my children and what's in the village, to help my child access what is in the village that's good, and to protect my child from the things that are in the village that are bad. And my own concern, particularly for African-American children, is they grow up with only one parent to intervene in the village for them. with only one parent who has to protect them. I'm really concerned about this for boys. Not that black women aren't able to protect their children, but often black boys are unlikely to tell their mothers about what they're experiencing on the outside. Let me give you a story and as we're closing down. Mm-hmm. When I was 8 years old, it was the habit of my mother to take myself and my two brothers to the barbershop on a Saturday. We would get our hair cut, and that would give her some time for herself. She raised three of us all by herself. And in the barbershop is a strange place for socialization. And I once heard a conversation as a young boy. Some guy in the barbershop said, every time I pass a schoolyard, I reach in my pocket and take out the pennies and throw it over this fence because I never know how many children on the other side of that fence are mine. I'm 54 years old. I remember that conversation as if it were yesterday. And I wondered, is that the way my father feels about me? Is that the way most black children's fathers feel about them? But I did not go home and ask my mother what that meant. I knew that it would be painful for her, even though I didn't completely understand what was at issue. So I'm concerned that men often do not deliver on the behalf of their children. And I understand that black boys especially are hurt as a consequence of that. And I will spend the balance of my career attempting to turn that situation around.
We're getting close to the point where we're going to have to finish. You know, one of the things we do in academia is we take these enormous social problems and then we come up with ambitious 10-point programs to deal with them. I can't tell you the last 25 years how many people I've interviewed have written books just like that. Given the difficulty of getting even 1-point programs through, you know, if you were going to do just one thing, if we were going to take if we had the money, we're going to put it into just one thing. What do you think would be the most productive thing that we could do, where we get the most return for having spent that money?
I think in the long term, we're going to get the biggest return, and this is not going to surprise your audience, by increasing the number of children who grow up with both of their parents. We're going to do part of that by increasing marriage rates in the United States. We're going to do another part of that by increasing responsible fatherhood. That is to say, so that when parents choose not to marry because this is the situation that does not work for them, that they learn how to conspire together to raise and support that children, their children. I think to the extent that we can do those things, we will be less reliant upon others for the raising of children. There will be fewer children who don't have all the resources they need. So we will be able to concentrate the resources that remain for children who don't have the benefit of both of their parents.
Our guest this morning, Ronald Mincy. He is a professor of social policy and social work practice at the School of Social Work at Columbia University in New York. He's here on a visit sponsored by the folks in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics. If you'd like to look at some of the research that he and others have been doing, taking a look at the lives of black men in the United States, you could look for the book Black Males Left Behind. It is published by the Urban Institute Press, available in a paperback. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute. With offices in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The broadcast is also made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive just off Veterans Parkway, and Washington in Bloomington, serving Bloomington Normal and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. Grand opening taste test day will be held on Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222. We're going to break as we usually do. We'll have news for you at 1 minute past the hour, then the markets, then we'll be back. So stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Produced